In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Culture Lab. I'm Christy Taylor. This is the show all about how science plays out in our cultural creations. Sometimes we talk about the science behind popular TV and movies. Other times we talk to artists and authors about the research that influenced their works. And what is more omnipresent in our culture right now than the rising tide of generative artificial intelligence? Companies are racing to find the most useful, or at least the most profitable, use cases for large language models, image-generating algorithms, and other tools. But there are many critics who have noted that this wave of chatbots and video fakers are error-prone, ripe for abuse, and primed to reinforce historic structural injustices. Author Meredith Broussard is one of those critics. She's a data journalist at New York University, and much of her work examines the flaws and biases in digital tools like generative AI. Her newest book is More Than a Glitch, Confronting Race, Gender, and Ability Bias in Tech. And Sophie Bushwick interviewed her not too long ago. Enjoy the interview.
Under the overarching umbrella of what I'm hoping to discuss today is just trust in AI. How much people trust and how much people should trust the systems that we have today. So you've coined the term techno-chauvinism. Can you define that for us?
Sure. Techno-chauvinism is a kind of bias, a kind of pro-technology bias that says that technological solutions are superior to others. What I would argue instead is that it's really about what is the right tool for the task, because sometimes the right tool for the task is undoubtedly a computer. Sometimes it's something simple like a book in the hands of a child sitting on a parent's lap. One is not inherently better than the other. So we need to kind of back off from techno-chauvinism in order to make really good decisions about how and if we use technologies.
At the same time as there's this idea of bias towards machines, there's been recent surveys like from the Pew Research Center saying that the majority of people in the U.S. actually distrust AI and feel suspicious of it. So how do you kind of square those two beliefs?
Well, I'm really interested in risk perception and marketing and the way these things collide when it comes to technology, right? So AI is the really hot technology right now. The kind of AI that we have is called machine learning. It is a kind of computational statistics on steroids. But there's all this magical thinking around it, which is really strange to me. And there are all these inflated claims. I am a journalism professor, and one of the first things that people always say when there's some new technology is, oh, this is going to replace all the journalists. Mm-hmm. And we have definitely seen some publications trying to use AI to replace journalists. And in the case of, say, Sports Illustrated, like, it has been a total disaster.
Yes. Right?
So business people making decisions about AI have not always had the greatest track record, when it comes to journalism, at least.
Right. So I guess the idea is that this distrust and suspicion that people have isn't based on the actual capabilities of the AI, but on this sort of marketing around it?
Well, I think that it's not really about AI is good or AI is bad. It's about AI in context, right? So a particular computer program doing a particular thing can be helpful or can be harmful. And we kind of want to make these big sweeping generalizations, but it's kind of absurd to imagine that there's going to be one machine that's going to solve every problem in the world.
And when people picture AI, I think that there's a lot of things that go into what they think of when they hear that term. So can you talk a little bit about the things that have influenced the way people perceive AI? I'm thinking of things like the tendency to anthropomorphize a chatbot, or about the long history of science fiction where AI is essentially a person.
Oh yeah, science fiction has such a stranglehold on our collective imagination. So when we think about artificial intelligence, we tend to think about things that come from Hollywood. Like we think about the Terminator or Ex Machina or Her or Star Trek or Star Wars, right? These are all beautifully told stories. But the reason for this is that our brains are better at remembering stories than they are at remembering facts and statistics, right? So Hollywood tells amazing stories, so that's where our brains go first, right? So we need to fight against that tendency, and we need to not get carried away and imagine that science fiction is a template for what we should make, right? It is an imaginative look at a story, or it's something abstract. You know, often science fiction is about hubris, right? Minority Report is a really good example of this. Minority Report is this Tom Cruise movie where they have these teenagers who like swim in goo and predict future crimes. And, you know, arguably the creators meant it as a cautionary tale, but there are lots of people who have taken it as instructions and have tried to create software that predicts future crimes. Well, guess what? That software is always biased against people of color, against vulnerable groups. It just doesn't work that well. So these kind of deep down collective fantasies about knowing the future, which is, by the way, impossible, are just really deep seated, and people keep coming back to them over and over.
I think there is an idea that what the AI is doing is predicting the future, but it's actually reflecting the past. Can you talk about that a little?
That's exactly how it works. So what we do when we create a machine learning system is we take a whole bunch of data, we dump it into the computer, and we say, computer, make a model. And the model shows the mathematical patterns in the data. And then we can use that model to do all kinds of cool things like make decisions or make predictions or generate new text or images or audio or video. The thing to keep in mind is that the decisions or predictions that the model is making, no matter what kind of AI you're using, those decisions are based on what has happened in the past. So the model is actually reproducing the past with all of its flaws. It's not getting us toward a better future. So one example I like to use comes from The Markup. The Markup is a really terrific tech investigation outlet, and they investigated a few years ago mortgage approval algorithms, automated mortgage approval algorithms. What they found was that these algorithms were 40 to 80% more likely to deny borrowers of color as opposed to their white counterparts. And in some metro areas, this disparity was more than 250%, right? Wow. And so it's wild, right? So why is this? Why was the algorithm being so racist? Well, if we look at the history of financial discrimination in the United States, a couple of possible explanations become clear. There is a history of financial discrimination in lending in the United States. There's a very long history of residential segregation. And so if you look at the patterns of who has gotten mortgages in the past, well, there's this very human pattern of bias. And then so that bias gets replicated in the computational system. Now, it is theoretically possible to put your finger on the scale and remedy those historical biases, historical ills, but not enough people are doing that.
Okay, so this is a little off topic, but people have been chattering the past couple days about Google's Gemini model and the idea that when it generates images of humans, it tries to make them as diverse as possible. But what this leads to is people saying, you know, generate an image of soldiers in Richard III of England's army, and they show you a bunch of very diverse faces that probably were not actually participants in the Wars of the Roses in 15th century England. That sounds like an example of Google attempting to remedy the whiteness of images that it was generating, but just like overcorrecting.
You know, there have been many such efforts. Adobe for a while was doing this thing in its image generator where it would look at where you were geographically and then the distribution of skin tones in the images of people that it gave you would be correlated with the average racial distribution in that country. So, I mean, people are trying to do stuff, but because this technology is so new and because it's so fundamentally flawed, nobody's really getting it right. You know, and the developers themselves, like, just do not have a sufficiently nuanced view of what the world is like. So what comes out of the computational systems ends up kind of blunted and off.
Can you give an example of that?
I think one of the fundamental problems is this idea that we can make rules that describe the way things happen in the world all the time. And this is absolutely true in physics and in math. Your goal when you're doing physics, when you're doing math, is to find some kind of theorem or formula that is true everywhere in every case throughout time, right? So like the Pythagorean theorem never stops being true. And computers are mathematical machines. And so one of the things that computer scientists often get wrong about making socio-technical systems is they kind of imagine that there's going to be some kind of rule that they can write that is going to govern an entire socio-technical system. And there isn't, right? And can you off the top of your head say what is a purely technical system and what is a socio-technical system? Well, nowadays, most of our systems are socio-technical systems. So unless you are embedding millions of rules about micro-level human interactions, like, your computer program is not going to be very good. Like, it's not going to replace in a sufficient way human interaction or human judgment.
What about this idea that you have an AI system making recommendations, but you keep a human in the loop to provide that human judgment, to have that sort of final say? Do you think that that is a potential solution for this, or do you think that that's still flawed?
I'm a big fan of human in the loop systems. What we have seen over and over again is that it's not about human-only systems. It's not about machine-only systems. It's about systems where humans and machines are working together, right? So the kind of capitalist imperative says, all right, well, let's just build machines to do everything, because then we could fire all the humans and we could make the most amount of money. And, you know, that's a wonderful fantasy. Like, I would absolutely love to have a machine that just spits out money all the time and I, you know, don't have to work or anything, but it's just not entirely practical. And so really what we need is we need humans who are gainfully employed, right? Because people like having jobs. People like having stuff to do and being useful in the world. I like having a job. So we need people and machines working together. We should think about designing socio-technical systems to help humans do their jobs and do their jobs better, instead of trying to design these systems that are going to just replace humans and generate maximum capital.
For me, this comes back to trust as well, though, because I think that a lot of the human in the loop systems assume that the human is going to be applying their independent judgment to whatever the AI says. But in reality, the human who's in the loop is going to have the same techno-chauvinism, the same views of AI that have been shaped by sci-fi as most of us do. And so what I think is, will this person be more inclined to trust the AI's judgment? So even though they're supposed to be be monitoring it? Will they just sort of green light what the AI says to do? Do you think that that's a possibility? And do you think there's any way to get around that?
I think we need a lot more education about what AI is and isn't. And let me give you an example from medicine that speaks to this issue of trust. So one of the things that I write about in the book is an experiment I did a couple of years ago where I took my own mammograms and ran them through an open source AI in order to write about the state of the art in AI-based cancer detection. Because you hear a lot about AI that people want to use to detect cancer. And, you know, as somebody who had breast cancer has now recovered, like I am extremely enthusiastic about the idea of there being more testing, more treatment, you know, more people surviving cancer. But one of the things that came up in my research that most people don't realize is that when you have an AI system that is evaluating a scan, like a mammogram, you have to decide how wrong you want this system to be. So mathematically, you have to decide if you want it to have a greater number of false positives or false negatives. So false negatives would mean that the system says, nope, no cancer, and you do actually have cancer. A false positive would mean that the system says, well, maybe cancer, and then you don't actually have cancer, but you go into, you know, another couple of weeks of testing and, you know, this kind of horrific in-between stage of, oh my God, is there something wrong, right? So both options are bad, and the false negative consequences are much greater, right? So these systems are tuned so you have greater rates of false positives. Now, there are people out there who think, oh yeah, well, I really want to get an AI scan in addition to my doctor, and I want to get this all the time because, you know, the AI is going to tell me if I'm, you know, if I have cancer, if I have a recurrence. And they imagine that the AI is going to set their minds at ease because they'll get this computational answer, right? But right, it's actually set to tell you that there's a problem more often than you imagine. So it's not actually doing the thing that you want it to do. There is no reassurance in the world. Like, we just have to live with some of this ambiguity, and it's terrifying. It's horrible, but that's how life is.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
So let's imagine that you are a person who's maybe you're in a situation where you have the opportunity to use an AI system, whether it's something that's going to be aiding your doctors with diagnosis, or whether it's, you know, deciding whether or not to use an AI chatbot's generated text. How do you assess whether you can trust the system's output? Is there anything you can do to analyze it and to see whether it would be a good use case for you?
You know, I recommend that everybody use a chatbot or use a generative AI system because it's really fun for like 10 minutes. And then you very quickly discover how boring the text is that it outputs, and you discover how kind of dull and uncreative it is. I mean, I don't personally enjoy interacting with chatbots. I didn't enjoy it in the pre-generative AI era. I like it even less now. I have never found a chatbot that works better than search. Mostly, they're just kind of annoying. So to me, people who want to implement chatbots are trying to get rid of jobs. They're trying to cut costs. They're trying to do less. And I don't think we're at the stage of life where we can do any less. I mean, things are already cut back to the bone. We need more people and more services, not fewer. So I'm sure that somebody has found a really useful use case for generative AI. I simply have not heard about it yet.
And for AI systems in general, the people who are developing these systems, what do you think they need to do to make sure that they are trustworthy or that they've mitigated some of their tendency towards problems like bias?
You know, I'm not sure that there is such a thing as trustworthy AI. I don't know why it's a goal to kind of make a machine that generates, say, Wikipedia type text. Like, I just don't know why anybody would do that. So I think that's where I go in terms of trustworthy AI. Obviously, it's really useful to use machines in a lot of situations. One of the things that's interesting to me is that we've all been using AI for years without realizing it. So for example, every time we do a Google search, it activates something like 250 different machine learning models. And you kind of expect when you're using AI, you expect it to feel special or magical somehow, but really it just feels like using technology. It just feels like using a computer. I should also say that one of the things that has been a rumor on the internet today is people have been posting all these things about ChatGPT is going crazy. Like it's generating all of this weird text and nobody knows why. And yeah, that's how these systems work. Like that is absolutely going to happen. There's no predicting when it will happen. Like it will always have a bunch of weirdness in it.
If you had the power to make the rules around regulations for AI, what regulations do you think would be good to have in place about the use of this kind of technology? And is it even possible to implement that in real life?
Well, if I made the rules for the entire universe, the universe would work a little bit differently, I have to say. So I have a very long list of things I would change, but where I would start with regulation is I would get much more aggressive about implementing existing laws inside AI systems, right? So I would enforce existing laws. I would also point people to the new EU AI legislation and the new executive order in the US around AI. I think the interesting thing about the EU AI Act is the way that it divides AI into high risk and low risk applications. So I think this is really good because we need to think about AI in context. It's not just about facial recognition as an abstract technology. It's about facial recognition, which is a kind of AI used by police on real-time video surveillance feeds or used to unlock your phone, right? Those are very different contexts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the AI facial recognition you use to unlock your phone, it doesn't work most of the time for me. It's not really a big deal. There's a backup passcode, whatever. So that's a low risk use, in my opinion, and that would not need to be regulated. But then police using facial recognition on real-time video surveillance feeds might be a high risk use because facial recognition is more inaccurate on people with darker skin. It misidentifies women more often than men. Trans and non-binary folks are generally misrecognized by it. So that is a higher risk application of AI, and that is something that would need to be regulated, registered, and monitored under the new EU regulations. So I think this high risk, low risk categorization is a really good way of starting.
I'm really glad you brought up the example of police using facial recognition because there have been a few examples of police using these systems and arresting someone or bringing them in for questioning because they think that the facial recognition has identified them. And then it turns out this person very clearly looks nothing like the surveillance photo, or they have a strong alibi for the time of when this crime was committed. And yet that evidence isn't weighted as heavily as the facial recognition evidence, and the person is, you know, forced to spend some time in jail, or they're forced to, you know, lose their own free time and their own time when they should be working, trying to defend themselves and trying to dig up things like alibis. So I find this telling because the police can see the pictures with their own eyes, but they're trusting the facial recognition system instead. Is there any way around that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, that's techno-chauvinism. That's the police trusting the computer more than people. Like, and it's trusting in the computational results, even in the face of credible reality-based evidence to the contrary, right? So the problem to me is too much faith in really fragile and rarely accurate technology. Facial recognition, I think there's something about it that is really hard for people to understand that it's such a fragile technology. Like maybe because faces are how people recognize each other. And so there's something really profound about it. But there have been a couple of cases lately of retail stores coming under fire for using facial recognition as a shoplifting deterrent. So Rite Aid, for example, was just involved in a case. The FTC said, Rite Aid pharmacy, or drugstore chain, you're not allowed to use facial recognition for 5 years because you have used it so badly. So what happened is Rite Aid bought a facial recognition system so that they could kind of use the video monitors in their store to flag people who they thought were shoplifters. And then they could also upload additional photos of people who they thought were shoplifters. Well, this is an example of the technology working badly, and then also people using the technology in a biased way, right? So The employees would flag more people of color, for example, as shoplifters or potential shoplifters. And then that's what the system learned to identify as a shoplifter. And then as the employees loaded in more photos of people who they thought were shoplifters, well, there was a clear bias in those photos. And so the system started flagging more and more and more women and people of color to the point where it was generating hundreds, if not thousands, of false alerts for, you know, say the same potential shoplifter at like hundreds of different Rite Aid stores. Like it worked really badly. So this is the kind of thing that happens all the time. And we need to focus on telling stories like that about how badly the software works, in addition to, you know, all of the marketing gung-ho excitement about, oh, this is going to be so trustworthy and so great, and it's going to transform your life.
What do you think is the biggest misconception about AI, or one of the most significant ones that you wish more people were aware of?
I think one of the things that people imagine about AI is that it's somehow going to deliver us from the essential problems of being human. People imagine that AI is this salvation, that there's some kind of magic or some kind of superior solution that is going to be inside, you know, the black box of AI. And that's just not it. I mean, an AI system is just a machine that does math. It does really complicated statistics, and it's super useful for a couple of things, but it's not magic, and it's not going to save us on any level.
And do you think now is a particularly important time to be spreading that awareness, that now when we've got so many people excited about generative AI?
Well, I've been an AI researcher for many years, and I used to go to cocktail parties and I would say, well, I work on AI, and people would kind of edge away, or like their eyes would glaze over. And so now I go to parties and I say, oh, I work on AI, and people are like, oh, that's so interesting, tell me more. So I'm really enthusiastic about more people talking about AI, not just because now, you know, people want to talk to me at cocktail parties, but also we all need more computational literacy. We need to know more about these systems that are increasingly making decisions on our behalf. And in order to be really good participants in our democracy. We need to understand these technologies, and we also need to push back when the technologies make decisions that are unjust or unfair.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Culture Lab from New Scientist Podcasts. That was Sophie Bushwick interviewing Meredith Broussard. If you liked this interview, make sure you subscribe to our feed for more like it. Plus, there's our weekly news podcast and the ever chaotic Dead Planet Society, all dropping right here every Friday and Tuesday. Find more journalists from New Scientist on our website at newscientist.com. I'm Christy Taylor. Bye for now.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.